Hey guys, we're sitting here in Anchorage, Alaska with Rick Zirkel. He's the Vice President of Airline Operations for Linden Air Cargo, which operates C-130s. Rick is the first person I met in Alaska, showed up here in December of 94. He was running a flight school for bush pilots, and I took a course from him. Basically, it helped get me a job at UDAIR and launched my Alaskan career. And Rick went on and became the chief pilot at Hagland Aviation, where I flew later on. He actually got me the job there. And then he's director of ops and has since continued on to Linden Air Cargo. So we're going to have a conversation with Rick about a little bit about his life and his career in aviation, how he ended up where he ended up. So Rick, let's just start. Let's start at the beginning with where you grew up and go in a little bit of your family, because I know you have aviation history in your family.
Yeah, that's pretty much what started my aviation career was my family. I grew up not very far from Willow Run Airport down there in near Ypsilanti, Michigan. Father was heavily involved in the old non-skedders, Zantop, Universal. My uncle Gene, who figured prominently in my choice of aviation as a career, was in the upper management of Zantop and then again in Universal. So from day one, I was exposed to aircraft of all types.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic your pop with the Zantop. I know Lyndon had a star with Zantop.
They did. It was about the fifth iteration of Zantop, as a lot of non-skid airlines go. Zantop had a lot of staying power, but it did go bankrupt once or twice in its career, but various entities and partnerships picked it back up, including members of the Zantop family, the second generation. And that is correct. Linden Air Cargo got its start in the 121 business by having Zantop fly their trips for them. It was Zantop aircraft, Zantop crew, the Electrus L-188s when they first started.
Yeah, that's full circle for you a little bit.
Yeah, I actually was not here at Linden Air Cargo when Zantop was still going. I had watched. I was still with Hagland out there in St. Mary's, and we used to do their turns in St. Mary's.
We just wondered who they were at first. We used to Northern Air Cargo and
roaring in these Electras and. My cousin was actually working for them at the time, and like any airline, they had their difficulties in starting up, so I was real secure at Hagland at the time, and just chose to watch and see what happened with them, and it turns out that they got their act together and built a pretty good airline.
Excellent.
From the start.
Let's back up a little bit. That was a little digression there, but I thought it was interesting. I didn't know your pop was involved with Zantop.
Yep.
Where did you start flying?
Arlington, Texas. 1986 or 87. I'd have to look. But it was right after I had a back surgery. I was pretty much unemployed. And while I was healing up.
Good time to be a pilot.
It was a good time. You get used to being broke for a while.
Yeah.
While I was healing up from that, I decided that I would go ahead and do the ground school portion of it. I'd always known that I wanted to be in the airline business. I was never real sure about the flying end of it. Always, you know, the business end is where the bulk of my family legacy was, although Gene was a captain for Zantop for many, many years. My father was never a 121 captain at all. He was always in on the business end of it.
So was that before or after college?
That was after college. I graduated from A&M in 1986, Texas A&M.
And you played football?
At Michigan State.
At Michigan State.
Yes, I did do that for a season.
So what type of flight school did you go to?
It was just a Part 61 school down there. It was close to where I was living, Arlington Muni. Cam Air, I think, was the name of it.
152s?
No, I was always a little too large for those, so I forked over the extra bucks for the 172.
All right, good man.
Made a little more comfortable.
And so after you finished flight school, did you go on to commercial license? Or?
I did. I got the bug. And I made the determination then, at least at that time in my life, that the flying portion is where I wanted to head. So I finished up my private pilot at Cam Air, and then got in on one of the first ab initio schools out there. It was the pilot entry program for Eastern Airlines.
Oh.
So that entailed me having to move from Arlington, which is near Dallas, down to Houston to attend the pilot entry program at San Jacinto College, which was just a junior college just south of Houston.
So is that supposed to lead to a job at Eastern at the time?
It was, yeah. That was during the real tumultuous time at Eastern, Lorenzo, and a real mess there. And me being as young as I was, I wasn't paying too much attention to union problems that they were having and was quite willing to, pay my money to get my commercial multi-engine CFI, I forget what else was included in the package, for a chance at going directly to the right seat, which was not a bad idea at the time.
Yeah, I mean, first, any time you get your first flying job, doesn't really matter what it is.
The problem was it was a very tumultuous time for Eastern, and while I was down there, I did actually get an interview. It wasn't with Eastern, it was with Continental, the Continental Express program, and the specific airline was Bar Harbor Express, which was one of their feeders up there in Maine, and I think they might even still be operating. I'm not real sure.
Well, yep, that was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. Well, it was, in the late 80s. And I did get the interview. I did not get the job, but I did get all my ratings and remained there in Houston for, another couple, 2 or 3 years. During that time, I was flight instructing. I flew a little bit of charter work, and I threw a lot of bags for Southwest Airlines at Houston Hobby.
Cool. That's a pretty standard aviation start.
That it is.
Where'd you get your first, I don't want to say real flying job, but your first, like Part 135 or 91 charter, where you were actually flying as a living, and that's what you were doing to make money and nothing else?
The entire time?
Yeah, but that's all you did. You're
that's all flying. I did. That was not until I moved to Alaska in 1991.
Okay, and that was with Mark Air.
Mark Air Express. That is correct.
And you flew first?
Started out in Dutch Harbor with a right seat in a Conquest 441. My uncle that I mentioned earlier was vice president of operations and maintenance for Mark Air.
Right, that was Gene Zirkel.
Gene Zirkel, correct. Yeah. And he had the foresight enough to get me in the right seat with a very experienced, extremely competent, but very difficult to get along with captain. He retired off the 737s from Mark Air, but was still flying the 135 part with me, and I spent 2 years with him in Dutch Harbor.
Wow, how'd you like Dutch?
Dutch was okay. You know, I was young.
Excited to be in Alaska.
Excited to be flying full-time for a living.
Yeah.
Even though Whether it was a real living or not is another story, but I was flying full-time.
What did Mark Air pay a co-pilot at Conquest in 91?
Oh, geez, you're going to make me reach back that far. I want to say I made $22 an hour.
Wow. How many hours a month were you?
There was, I think I had a 60 or 50-hour guarantee, or there may not even been a guarantee with that to start with.
I never remember a guarantee.
It's a long time ago. So. But fortunately out there, we did do a lot of flying. I mean, there was a lot of demand for that airplane. We had the Essential Air Service contract for the Pribs and for APCA and ADAC.
Okay, so you did, I know the Aleutians now, and it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of... You know, Penn Air goes out, but I don't see a lot of activity in Dutch in terms of commuter service.
No. Basically, Penn Air has that wrapped up. You know, there for a long time there was jet service going in and out of there. Both Mark Air and Alaska Airlines went in and out of there, and the Boeing 73s for a number of years, where they tried to pummel each other to death. and it was real busy for, on the Express end, we were real busy out there too, and it was Crab that drove a lot of it. Crab and Pollock, which still drives most of the economy out there in Dutch.
So you did a lot of probably fishermen charters too, getting them rounded about.
Yep. We used to go Dutch Harbor to St. Paul a lot, just on charters, beside the scheduled service that we provided.
So after Dutch, you moved into Anchorage.
Yeah, from Dutch. I built up a whole bunch of right seat time, but not very much PIC time. I came to Alaska with probably 650 total hours, and by the time I was done with the Dutch thing, I didn't have any PIC time.
Right.
So it was very difficult, and back then I didn't understand it. I was actually kind of upset because I was going from twin turbine aircraft in the right seat, both the 441 and then the Beech 1900 when we put that out there, to getting some PIC time in the stalwart 207 in Bethel.
I love 207.
You know, they're a wonderful airplane. They make a lot of money for a lot of operators. There's nothing wrong with that. But back then, that's not what I had in mind for my future. But I didn't have much choice. It was a pay raise.
That's good.
I went to over $30 an hour.
What was the difference between being right seat in Conquest in Dutch and PIC in the 207 in Bethel?
Making the decisions.
Making
the call. You always had, and I was, like I said, I was real fortunate. John Robert, as grouchy and as mean as he could be, if you could put up with that, I learned so much from that guy.
Did you try to model yourself after him?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
You don't have to answer that.
No, but I did try to use all the tools that he taught me, and he did teach me a lot about flying, first of all, out on the Aleutian chain, which has its own ways to do things, but overall, just flying in Alaska, because you've been up here a lot of years. You know what it's like to fly around out here.
Yeah, it seems like if you can get any training from someone who's been up here a while, but I did IOE with you there with Shapley Howell.
Wonderful guy.
And that was, it was only 10 hours.
The king of Nelson Island, as I recall. You can learn a lot from guys like that that have been around for as long as Shap had and Robert. And there's a whole bunch of them. I don't know if you remember Pokey.
No, it might have been at
Formby. He was at Mark Air Express. He's at the Feds now. Great guy. Wonderful twin otter driver. I learned a lot just from talking to him.
Mark Air at the Twin Otters out in Bethel.
They did. They had, at one time, Mark Air was a pretty good size outfit and provided a really good service. They had their own share of difficulties when Big Mark, as we used to call it, started having trouble. But they had some good equipment, and the Twin Otters were some of the best. That was one that I never got into, and I really wanted to.
I bet. Yeah, I've always had a fantasy with the Twin Otters, too.
It's in my estimation, like I said, I played around in them, but I was never checked out.
Right.
In it, it's the best bush airplane ever made.
Yeah.
And it's just a darn shame that they made that airplane have to go to Part 121.
No, to all the 19 passengers.
To have 19. To make it pay, you had to have 19. or the ability to carry 19. And when they changed the rules for 19, what did it go from 9 seats and above, you had to go Part 121. Right. That killed that airplane because nobody could turn it into a Part 121 airplane, except Era, I guess, did eventually, but they were doing it on a bunch of exemptions.
Right.
Nobody could meet 121 rules and regs in the bush. Just couldn't be done at that time.
Well, we'll touch on rules and regs. They've changed a lot out here since you've been up here. Let's not go into that right now, but
right.
we'll come back to that. That's, I mean, you've seen more changes than I have. So after Mark Air, you went to UDAIR.
I went to UDAIR for probably a couple of years.
St. Mary's?
Bethel to start, and then moved up to St. Mary's with my good buddy Ray Quino.
That's right.
He and I worked opposite shifts. I really enjoyed that aspect of it because we were co-station managers, and we'd be together for about a week out of the 4 week period where we were transitioning back and forth.
They have one 207 up there that you all switch shifts on.
We had that started out with one 207, and as Ray and I built that business and got into Haglund's back pocket up there, which we did. We ended up with two, and then it became a three pilot rotation. Of course, Ron. You remember Ron?
Oh yeah.
He
made sure he stole both of you in the end.
He did. He actually stole three of us, and that was because Mike Callahan.
Oh yeah, Callahan was up there too.
Was worked for me. Ray had already gone over to Haglund.
Right.
That left me in charge. I got another pilot, Mike Callahan, who was just a fantastic guy to work with, and he and I continued to cherry pick off Haglund. They were the main player in St. Mary's and that northern part of the Delta.
And everyone ended up there at the end.
But Ron and his, he paid a little bit better, and Ron had a certain charisma. You wanted to go to work for the guy.
Yeah, you did. You definitely did.
You just wanted to.
And you always felt like he was going somewhere.
You did. And he was.
And he did. Yeah.
And that was always a big problem that you would have in the bush, was keeping guys occupied. And, because I don't think a lot of people come to Alaska with the intent to stay in aviation in bush Alaska.
Right, yeah.
They come up here, at least when you and I were doing this, to build time.
Spend a year,
maybe two, get your PIC, learn to fly, and then start applying any other place.
What was the Mark Air mantra? Every day without an accident, incident, or something else, or the day closer to the airlines?
There was a bunch of mantras there, and I'm sure that was one of them. But Ron, even though I don't know if he ever really had the long-term plans that we were all looking for, at that time, he could make you believe he did.
Right.
And I think maybe in the back of his head, he did,
I think he did. I don't know if he knew exactly how it was going to happen, but I think he had an idea of...
Well, they did a lot, They brought in, when I was there, we only had the four stations, I want to say, Bethel, St. Mary's, Antioch, Unalakleet, and McGrath, right?
Yeah, McGrath was there, yep.
Yeah,
definitely.
We had McGrath. And, so five. And
1402.
1402 in St. Mary's. The rest of it was 207s and 1185 over there in
H-18.
Yeah, it was Jim. I'm not sure that it was ever on the certificate. I don't remember it ever when I was in charge.
That might have been the Gus Adventures.
It was Gus Adventures. Whatever he did.
Yeah.
It wasn't on the certificate. I didn't worry about it.
Yeah, that's. I mean, we could talk about Haglund.
Yes, we could.
Hopefully, I'll be talking to Mike Haglund later on, so we'll I'll save some of that. Those were good old days.
Yeah, they were. But Ron had a way of making you believe that things were going to happen, and they actually did.
They definitely did.
And so he got us all.
Yeah, he did. Definitely.
He got us all, and you'd eventually. They tried to bring those metros in, and they did for a while, and I think they were doing all right with them. But Will Smith was, as many airline owners, small airline owners, had dreams and plans bigger than his back pocket.
Yeah,
and eventually
didn't work out.
Didn't work for that, yeah, unfortunately. But he was another good guy. I really liked Will.
He was. He always had his own meter with him.
Yeah, he was scientific all the way through.
He could solve any problem in 207 with his own meter. I was always amazed.
Yeah.
So you left, you between Ute and Haglund, you went and ran your flight school with
him. I did. I had to get out of the bush for a while and was reassessing what I was going to do. And I was really thinking about going back to Little Friend. By then, I had my ATP and thought I might be heading back to the lower 48, and I came back into town, and my uncle had a flight school and a little 135 outfit here on Lake Hood, and one of the things, so he asked me to come over and run that portion for it. He was much more into the maintenance end by then.
Right.
And I did put together, and I think it was the first of its kind, and as a Bush Pilot Training School, and
yeah,
it's just based on some of the things that I went through in Western Alaska in single engine reciprocated powered aircraft, and thought that there was room for something like what I put together, and I did pitch it at Ute. They actually thought it was a good idea. Their insurance company thought it was a good idea. And I can proudly say of everybody who went through that, and off the top of my head, I can't remember, but it was probably 20 or 25 that went through that did go to work.
Yeah. Now, people are giving me shit for, you know, they always say, oh, you shouldn't pay for training. You know, I made more money at Ute Air in the first 2 months than I was making flying skydivers. It paid for itself like that. And
yeah,
I actually don't think it was a bad program.
It wasn't a bad program. And you remember what we used to, what I did. I just try to simulate what you'd be facing out there.
Yeah.
And,
it was 10 hours in a
207, number one, which most guys had not seen. Some had seen 206s, but you don't see 207s down there. And it's a little bit of a different airplane. It's longer. You can certainly get more in it.
Now, the only gripe is the 207 you were using was really nice.
It was a nice one.
And you never saw a plane that nice until Haglund bought it.
That's correct.
I flew it every chance I got.
That's correct. Seven Gulf November. Yeah, but, you know, we used to load that thing up to max capacity with those metal box with the metal in it.
That, of course, is exactly how you loaded it in the bush, right to max capacity.
Right to max capacity. And then we'd go out and we'd play, and it wouldn't. Play, but we'd go out and we'd practice the short, soft, all the techniques, flying a gross weight, which most guys never do when they come into an entry-level position. Well, and then it'd teach you a few things that I'd learned. I don't know if you remember some of the things we did with the flaps to get her turned around quickly.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
How to get out of a runway with about a foot of snow on it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you taught me very well that when you land with a lot of snow on the runway and someone's got to tramp the runway out, you go to glance the flight plan and everyone else in the plane makes the runway.
And that's what happens in the bush, you know. You get a whole load of people in there, you get to a place you can't get out. I did that several times at Mark Air and Air Express in the 207 and the King Salmon, stuck in runways because of mud, and I had the whole... Not one of them spoke English, but a bunch of Japanese guys pushing me out of the runway at Coffee Point because I was just stuck. It wasn't going nowhere, but we wanted to get out. So they got me out of the hole I was in there, push, push, push. They were covered with mud, and as soon as I got out of the hole, they I stopped. They hopped in, and we took off.
How do you think, before we go on from here, a couple things. One is, what was the living like out in the villages, and how do you think things have changed flying out there versus now?
Well, I know, first of all, the pay is substantially better,
again,
depending on who you work for. I do believe they've addressed at least some of that. There was a big housing shortage out in Western Alaska when you and I were out there. And it's extremely expensive,
right?
Even if you could find it. So you ended up for instance, when I was in Bethel.
Trailers.
No, I didn't live in the trailers. When I was in Bethel with Mark Air Express, we had a house out there at, was it Blueberry Hill? Is that what
yeah,
you called
yeah,
it out
yeah,
there?
I think that's, I think
there
that's
were
right.
19 of us sharing that place, and you know, not all there at the same time, but a substantial amount, over
right.
10 every time. We had people sleeping in the closets. We had, you know, it was a regular occurrence to run out of water because, of course, it's tank water.
Right.
And,
of course,
Mark Air Express was not very forthcoming on additional water supply, and we would inevitably run out by about Wednesday. It was delivered once a week, and so there'd be two or three days without water. It's just a tough way to live.
I remember this from at the time that I was out there, and probably when you're younger, that's kind of fun and exciting. As an older pilot, it's not something you're
interested in. Don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah, it does seem like housing. That the
housing, and I think it's come a long way now. It's been many, many years since I've actually had to go up there and live for any length of time.
Right.
But from what I understand, and I kind of keep my ear to the ground a little bit, it's come a long way. The companies out there have addressed that issue, either
trying
building
to keep
their
people
own.
Longer.
Yeah, they have to because it's expensive to train guys.
Right.
And experience in Western Alaska is the key.
Right. If your first year is like a big learning curve.
That's right. And once a company expends the kind of resources that they really should and need to turn you into a good, and I hate the term bush pilot, but
yeah.
a good pilot in Western Alaska or any
air taxi pilot
rural setting in Alaska, they need to keep you.
Yeah. It seems like Mark Air, Ute Air, it's about 6 months to a year people were out of there.
Yeah, and because most, you know, you don't, except for a few of us, just didn't want to live that way.
Right.
And it was tough living, it was tough flying, and you had to do a lot of things on your own, which a lot of people aren't willing to do.
Right.
And weren't willing to do back then.
Yeah, Bethel, when I got there, always felt like I was in the trenches in World War I.
Yep.
The airports were shitty, the weather was shitty, living
yep.
was shitty.
Yep. It was.
Yeah.
It was. It was tough flying all the way around.
It was. I mean, it was fun at the time, though. And you stayed with Hagman for quite a few years.
Yeah, from 96, was it?
I think it was.
95.
95, you were back that summer.
Yep.
Yep.
95. Until 99 when I came here to Linden Air Cargo. July of 99 was my hire date here.
You saw Hagman change a lot.
Yeah.
Over that time.
Yeah, they were doing very well.
Yeah.
Monetarily, and Ron really did want to build that business, and he did.
Yeah,
and
he did.
And they did it the right way too. As far as infrastructure, you wouldn't show up, for the most part, to any of these new bases where you didn't have
anything,
an office, and at most places a hangar.
Right.
Or if not a hangar, a good place to operate out of at the airport.
And I know he tried, like he brought Ray Quinto back when Cots was going. And
yep.
He tried to bring people back that knew were good.
Yep. Yep, and
yeah.
he did, and Ray did come back up for quite some time out of COTS, and then we move other people into those places that were good
right.
and had some experience.
Yeah. Excellent. Like I said, we won't go too far into Hagman's. I'll be talking to them over there. We could talk for, hours and hours. I mean, I feel like Hagman was kind of that's where I learned aviation, and I suspect that even with Mark Air behind you, Hagman was still a pretty big...
Yeah, it was. It's where I got more, I continued to hone my skills flying in Western Alaska, but that's where I cut my teeth on the management end of things.
Right, yeah. That's when you started getting back into management.
That's right.
Yeah, you came to...
I moved to chief pilot at Hagman very shortly after I went to work there, and from there on to the director of operations for...
How do you find working in management, dealing with the FAA and the airlines? And the airlines are often at odds with what they want to do. Is it an easy to work between the two?
It can be. I don't think, and I've changed this view over the years. Of course, when I first started, I felt like the FAA was almost the enemy.
Yeah.
I don't believe that to be the case anymore, right. And I don't think it ever truly was. I think that the FAA, at least in Alaska at that time, was going through what a lot of the carriers were, and that was a depth of truly experienced people,
right,
that understood the vagaries of operating in rural Alaska. And it was difficult to operate. And everybody did their best to stay within the rules. I know the training was always set that way. The problem was, in my estimation, at least at that time, they didn't have the knowledge of how it should be set up any more than some of the carriers did.
Right.
And just throwing a rule book at people will never ever solve a problem, and that goes today.
Right.
I'm sure later on we'll get into it, but
yeah, it seemed like the best way. I mean, I certainly had some little small run-ins with the FAA, and the best way to deal with it always was to be professional and
absolutely.
Generally, if you could talk about
absolutely.
It and not get mad, you were
absolutely
leaps and bounds ahead.
Absolutely, that is the way to be. And like I said, I've changed over the years as I've gotten grayer and saltier and won my share of arguments with them and lost my share of arguments with them. I don't think the FAA is the enemy at all anymore.
It helps. I mean, you're at a 121 carrier now where everything is, not that things weren't above board in Western Alaska, but 121, it's very obvious, it's very clear, it seems like. That, you
know, well, it's like anything, there's, it's how you set it up, and it's how you want to operate, and that's the bottom line at any carrier. I don't care, from a single pilot 135 operation to Delta Airlines, it comes down to integrity, it comes down to making up your mind that you are going to do the best job and stay within the regulations every day.
And work, and it does seem like you can work with the FAA if you're doing that.
You say, can.
We want to do this.
You can.
How can we make this happen?
You can.
And as long as you're forthcoming, they tend to come back and say, okay, well,
you can.
This is how we can make this work.
Absolutely.
Cool.
And there is no substitute for knowledge of the rules and regulations and how you can make those rules and regulations work for you.
Right.
Staying within them, but fully understanding them.
Right.
And saying, okay, this, and also separating what's legal and what's smart, because there's a lot of things that are legal for us to do.
Yeah.
But I don't consider them smart.
Right.
So we don't do them.
Yeah, you can dig around the rules and find a way to get away with doing something, but that's all you're doing is getting away with it.
That's it. And yeah. In the long run, that type of operation ends up, or that particular operation ends up hurting you.
Right, yeah.
In some fashion or another.
Cool, let's get off the FAA now. It's depressing. Well, I think we both know more and more people have gone to the FAA now, which is always interesting to watch someone transition from the commercial side to the government side. But
there's always some changes, aren't there?
Always are. So you've left Taglin, came to Linden as a line pilot,
as a first officer.
Okay.
In the L-382, or most people would know it as a C-130, although ours are the stretch version. L-100, the Air Force calls them.
Okay.
Longer than what the National Guard flies.
And flying all cargo?
All cargo.
And Linden's a huge company that has a lot of transportation.
Linden Inc. is a multimodal transportation, logistics, and construction company.
Okay, with trucks and hovercrafts.
They've got several different trucking lines. They do have hovercraft that currently are operating in Western Alaska, and I believe they've had one or two operate in this season on the slope somewhere. But
I heard about that actually. Yeah.
Construction. They built a lot of the runways in Western Alaska.
I didn't know that. They've done a lot of that in the last 10 years.
Yep. And around the world, not just there. They redid the runway at Wake.
Wow.
They've done a lot of stuff around the world. It's a big company. Most people don't know how big this company is. It's a very large company. And Lindon Air Cargo is just one. And I should know how many total companies there are. And forgive me, Jim Jansen. I'm sorry, I can't pull it out of my head right now. Quite a few companies, and all pretty successful.
What do you think, and you obviously don't know what the owners are thinking, why did they get into aviation?
It fit their idea of a niche operation. I think they always had their eyes on the C-130.
Got it.
And that airplane is a very niche airplane. It was operated very successfully for a number of years by Southern Air. Southern Air, it was back then was Southern Air Transport, now it's Southern Air, under a different ownership. But they did a number of years and very successfully with this airplane. It fit Jim Jansen's and the Jansen family's idea of the type of business that works for them. And Jim Jansen is also an aviation buff, but I don't think that played a big role. He's smarter than that.
Right.
Well, you have to see something in it. You have to see some money being made in it, and not just do it because you love it.
Well, he's done something right with aviation. You know, we always joke it's easy to get into aviation with a lot of money.
Take a big pile of money and come out with a small pile.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is, I think, true. You have to find a niche, and they did, and it all came together at the same time. Southern Air had, of course, gone into 747s and spent a lot of money doing that type of business, and there's a million 747 operators out there, and it's just a tough racket.
Yeah, you've got a plane that not that many people fly.
That's right.
But as long as we're on Lindon, we'll come back to your career. Let's talk about Lindon a little bit. C-130s, who is your competition? How many operators worldwide?
There's one other 121 operated, Park 121 operated Herc in the United States. That's based in South Carolina. There's a part, I believe they're Park 125 operator.
Okay.
That is no competition, but right. We're not in the same market.
Right, yeah, 125 is very, I mean, that's what Everett's Air Fuel was. That's a niche market.
They do stuff that we don't do,
right.
So they're not a competitor. Our worldwide competitors basically are a company in Johannesburg, South Africa called SAF Air.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
And another one, I'm not sure where they're based now. I think Uganda. It's called Transafrique.
For them too.
And
okay.
Got each one of those each have about the same number of airplanes we have now. At one time, SAF Air was a lot larger. They had 14 or 15 Hercs, and they've slowly. I don't believe that they want to stay in the business for a long time, but you know, they're still going and they still do a good job. And they're probably our main competitor. Transafrique is, I want to say, a little bit more of a cut rate.
Right. I've spent time in Uganda. If you're based in Uganda, nothing
speaks
wrong.
Enough.
Yeah, exactly.
They do things a little differently than we do. Both the companies actually do a little bit differently than we do. We believe in really spending the money to keep these airplanes in shape, whereas I know for a fact Transafrique considers them throwaways.
Right.
They'll do the minimum to meet the requirement, but that's it.
And I've seen SAF Air in the Congo, and they always seem pretty dialed, pretty together.
Yeah, SAF Air does a good job. I would say they're not on par with us.
Yeah.
As far as maintenance and what we do to the airplanes to keep them able to operate all around the world.
Right.
But they're pretty good. And then there's one other operator in Dubai, it might be Abu Dhabi, and that's Maximus, and I believe right now they have two aircraft that are, and they're also
pretty good.
Pretty good. They spend the money, but they tend to stay more in the Middle East, and the Middle East is, for us, is not a big market. We do a little work over there, but not much.
All right. Well, that's, I mean, that's just sort of established. You are a niche market. There aren't that many operators out there, and if someone needs a Herc.
No, if they need a, if they, I like to consider us, and I believe we are probably the premier outfit operating these airplanes, and we're also probably the most expensive, although I think Maximus is fairly close to us in price.
Yeah.
But we meet all the, you know, we have to meet the 121
FAA
standards,
121 regs.
And they are stiff. Especially when you're operating older aircraft.
Definitely. You've got to meet the same standards as Delta, United,
Absolutely.
All those guys.
Absolutely.
What is your... you've got six Hercs, six C-130s.
That's correct.
Are they all based in the U.S., or do you have them based in...
No, we're a worldwide operation. We carry operation specifications for just about any place you can think of.
Okay.
Right now, we have one... and at times two aircraft up here in Alaska, depending on the need. We have one on contract to the United States Air Force out of McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. That one runs down to South America, out to the Azores, and up to Thule Greenland. We have... usually have one of the aircraft in check, which is the case right now. We have one in Southeast Asia, usually in the Singapore or Malaysia market, and that is the case right at the moment. And then we have one over in Papua New Guinea on contract.
Those are, you've got DOD contracts, obviously, Air Force.
That's correct.
And you also respond, I mean, you're available for charters from pretty much anyone.
Yeah, that's the ad hoc. And that's...
You responded to Haiti.
We did. We were, I want to say, and you'll have to fact check me on this, but I believe we were the first commercial carrier into Haiti after the earthquake. We'd been going into Haiti for years.
Right, yeah.
But I believe we were the first, if not very close to the first commercial aircraft in there after the earthquake. And we ran 40 or 50 trips into there. And again, for me to be precise, I have to pull the records out.
Yeah, 40. So how much, what's your payload? Like for a Haiti flight, what's your, how many pounds?
Most of those
carrying?
Operated out of Miami.
Okay.
And there was no fuel available down in Haiti at the time, so we were carrying round trip fuel. So again, Aiden, I can't be precise, but I'm quite certain we could carry 35 to 40,000 pounds, and that's carrying the round trip fuel.
It's a good load.
Yeah, a very good load, and it's it's the bulk load kind of thing. I mean, it's palletized. We just take it right into the back, strap it down, and away you go. That's what the airplane's built for.
Yeah.
It's a great airplane for that.
And you drive trucks in the back. I know you do that in Alaska a lot.
Yep. Well, all kinds of things driven in the back. Bulldozers, scrapers, you name it, we put it in the back up here. I mean, Alaska needs that kind of...
Well, I think up here, since Northern Air lost their last swing-tail DC-6, you're the only people who can haul the oversized vehicles.
That's correct.
Like big vans, big trucks.
That's correct.
So that's kind of that's nice, unless it comes up in a barge. So you do have some competition.
And a lot of people, because we are expensive. Okay. And now I don't believe we raised our prices at all. It's just we were always more expensive than the DC-6s.
Right.
But if you need it there and you need it there quick, then we're pretty much the only game in town for the outsized wheeled vehicles.
And for your crews then, so kind of on to pilot life, and then we'll still getting back to your career. but you start flying right seat, and
yes,
you move up to the left seat's captain, which I think
that's correct.
Happened within, you're pretty quick.
Yeah, I hit it just about right. Like I said, I'd been watching them from St. Mary's for a number of years. They started in '96, and I didn't come over here until '99. So they'd had 3 years to kind of work through some of the growing pains that any company goes through. And it wasn't through any big analysis that I made. I just hit it right. I showed up here in July of 99. I was online by September of 99. I flew right seat until February of 2000. Okay. And by March of 2000, I was in the left seat.
Is that so? Upgrading a captain. Everybody wants to be a captain. Of course, it really just depends on when you get on, and what's happening in the industry. And
at this particular company, because they are. While we follow, for the most part, a union type program as far as bid schedules, bidding for vacation, they have. They do not necessarily upgrade in seniority because of the specialized work that we do and the places that we go. The upgrade policy here is more of merit rather than seniority.
Got it. And you've got the what do you call the captains up here who fly to the shorter strips or the...
Our 80%.
Your 80% guys.
Captains, yeah. And that's tightly controlled.
Yeah.
Because it's... The airplane is more than capable of doing what we do.
Right.
Performance-wise. But it does take technique. It does... And anybody can slap it on and do it once or twice. But we want guys that can do it consistently and not break the airplane to pieces while they're doing it.
So you're taking your guys that you feel are, not more competent, that'd be the wrong way, but guys are maybe more experienced, maybe spent more time in Alaska.
I would say the bulk of our 80% captains were, if not born and bred in aviation in Alaska, have spent a substantial amount of time up here flying the bush in for various companies, so they're very familiar with the areas, and they're very familiar with the terrain, and they're very familiar with the techniques that are required to do what we do with these airplanes on the shorter strips.
Excellent. Do you find some guys want to be based in Alaska and just run Alaskan like a?
We've been a kind of a combination of a lot of different past operations. We have a lot of guys. Originally, we had a lot of guys that came over from Southern Air. Now, as everybody's getting older, a lot of them are retiring or have retired. And then we had quite a few from the Mark Air Herc operation.
Okay.
And then we have quite a few. I lump Mark Air with AIA. Which was the big operator of Herc's on the North Slope when they were building the pipeline.
That stood for
Alaska International Airways, I think.
Okay. Yeah, there's so much.
Before my time.
Yeah, I think always
when I came up here, it was the Mark Air, and they bought Neil Burke, we all know, he owned AIA at one time, and through various maneuverings, ended up with a passenger certificate for Mark Air, and the story goes on. We had a substantial number of guys come over from Southern Air that I mentioned earlier, which was a very successful Herc outfit. And then we had quite a few guys with strictly military Herc experience. So we had a nice mix, and it wasn't always pleasant because you got guys that learned one way and guys that learned the other way, and guys that law of primacy always.
Yep.
Shows up. So I came aboard when they were still fussing around quite a bit about how to actually fly this airplane.
Right. I know you've hired a lot of people who flew out in bush a lot, Western Alaska.
Yeah, I like guys. That's one, and it's not a necessity because we've hired quite a few that have not had a lot of bush experience.
Right.
But our druthers, is some people or pilots that have had either substantial bush experience in Alaska or in other parts of the world.
Okay. So like flying in Africa or
flying in Africa
South
would
America.
Be,
or,
yeah. But places well. Where you still have to
think out the box, outside the box.
Exactly.
Because you're,
I mean, we
you're,
do specialized work.
Right. You're still 121. You're operating
yes.
for 121.
Yes.
But like if you're in New Guinea, you might be flying into a strip where you're not shooting an ILS.
That would be and the norm rather okay. than the exception.
Right.
Port Moresby is the only one that I'm aware of there that has an ILS, although Lay might, and that's where we're based out of right now. But when we go into the Southern Highlands, there's no ILSs.
Right. Yeah, so people have to think, and yeah, we don't mean outside the box by being crazy or anything.
Just no, I just you have to be able to make the decisions.
This doesn't look good.
You don't,
going
you,
back.
There's not ATC. In Papua New Guinea, for example, there's very little radar. Any radar that they have, I believe, is right there at Port Moresby. But by and large, it's a lot like flying in Western Alaska used to be, where there wasn't a lot of radar coverage. There wasn't a lot of external sources for help.
Right. Right. What's life like for your pilots when they're at, I mean, in Anchorage, they're home every night, more or less.
Yeah. Anchorage is... We have pretty much three types of schedules. The Anchorage schedules are basically a week on, week off, and they can vary from a whole lot of flying, depending on which line. There's four published lines in Alaska right now, to not a whole lot of flying. Everybody here, of course, is on a 60-hour guarantee, and we have you can get into how we structure our pay. There's lots of ways to rig it.
Yeah, I know you
to where you everybody gets more than their 60-hour guarantee.
Right. I know you've got a bunch of different ways of getting pay and depending where you're based, and we
exactly.
don't need all the details. But
so Alaska is basically a week on, week off for the entire month. We put out a monthly bid. The guys bid it. Our lower 48 operation, pretty much the rest of the operation, it's a 2 week on, 2 week off, although we do change that a little bit. We have, at least for the Papua New Guinea operation, because it is a long trip to Papua New Guinea from just anywhere in the States, and it seems to work a little bit better for the guys to do a 3 and 3. Plus, the rotation works for us in that we have one less rotation we have to pay to get them over on. So, 3 and 3 for right now for the Papua New Guinea operation. But by and large, if you were to come to here, it'd be a 2 on, 2 off type deal. You do not have to be based in Alaska.
I know a bunch of people have come to started flying for you. This might be unofficial, but you sort of request that when you start that you live in Anchorage first year or two?
Depending on the position.
Okay.
For flight crew, probably not a necessity. For the pilot and the first officer, probably not a necessity that you live in Alaska for any time whatsoever.
Okay.
For our engineers, at one time we did have a bit of a shortage of Alaska-based engineers, so we did put in the requirement that you spend at least a year up here before you move off. We've since gotten through that time, and I think right now if we were to hire, that would not be a requirement. Although, it certainly is a good place to be to move your career ahead.
It's beneficial if someone's trying to get a job if they are planning on living in Anchorage. That would be an edge up on someone for living in Texas.
It would be, the jump would be that you've flown in Alaska.
Right.
Certainly, if I had two equally qualified candidates for, say, a first officer position, and our first officers generally come to us with a substantial amount of total time and a
right.
substantial amount of DIC. If I had two guys with the same amount, And one guy had spent a few years up here, even 10 years ago, flying western Alaska or southeastern Alaska or the slope or out on the chain. And the other candidate, although equally qualified as far as time, had no Alaska experience or no experience we would consider bush, for lack of a better word, then the person with bush experience would probably be the one that we would choose.
And that would edge out international experience.
It would, because we can teach the international flying. It's certainly helpful to have some of that, but I came here with zero international experience.
Right.
And it was not difficult to learn. I spent a lot of time overseas learning it, but the trick is to find somebody that's got both, if you can find them. But of the two, I would say that type, the bush type flying, would be the preference for us.
So in other words, if you didn't know me as well as you know me, you'd hire me.
Exactly. How many times did I hire you, Aiden?
Hey, and then brought you back.
All right. Now, but you would be a prime candidate for us if I didn't know you. Because you have, you've had some international experience, you've had ample bush experience, you got the twin turbine time we look for,
DC-6.
You got the PIC time that we look for.
Do you think that air, what is it, the air transport category, the larger aircraft, that factor in?
Sure. If you've had some large aircraft experience, that would be fantastic, but it certainly is not. I've taken guys with none. No transport. I had no transport category experience when I came here.
Right. But you do operate as a crew. I know you're a professional flight engineer.
That's correct.
So you're either going to be hired as an engineer or an FO or a captain.
We have not hired anybody off the street as a captain.
Ever.
They did early on, HERC captains.
Okay.
Because they didn't have enough HERC captains to go, and they bought the first two airplanes, I think, at the same time. So they had a few experienced captains from ARC Air, but they didn't have enough to do the worldwide operation. So they did bring some Southern Air captains straight across as captains, but not since probably 98 or... I know not since I've been here, and it's been since 99, has anybody been hired into the left seat. And there would be, I can't see a reason for us to do that now. I've got an ample supply of fully upgradable FOs right now that, 90% of them I could throw in the left seat tomorrow and sleep like a baby.
I know several of them, and they're definitely... They're just waiting for this,
and that now it's a waiting game.
Yeah.
We're actually in really good shape as far as the experience factor of our crews. I would venture a guess that we have one of the most experienced airlines out there. We did a little...
Based on your FOs, I don't know many of your captains, but
we just did this here not too long ago, and I want to say our average total time for captains is over 16,000 hours, and that's average total time. And I want to say our FOs are in the 10,000 mark range, and again, I'd have to look back to give you a complete...
So if someone wanted to apply here, I'm sure you have minimum hour requirements, but you're probably hiring way above your minimums.
We have, we have a 5,000 hour minimum total time. We got it in the GOM here. We'd like to see some twin turbine PIC of some kind.
Right.
We haven't necessarily always held to that, but I don't, over the last, since I've been either director of operations or vice president of airline operations, we have no problem meeting our minimum requirements as posted in the GOM, let alone, I mean, those most of the guys that come here have substantially higher. It's a nice place to work for guys that want to do this kind of work, and it's a little bit different than you might have at some of the other larger 121 airlines.
The cargo guys.
All cargo guys. Yeah. And there's a lot of quality outfits out there, Atlas, Polar, and of course you get the big two all cargo, FedEx and UPS, which everybody at one time I think probably aspired to going to. But again, we do some really different things, and that appeals to a lot of guys. Yeah. I would never have been one that would have done well at
just at a number
of FedEx or UPS or any of them, although I think they're wonderful outfits, very well run.
How many pilots do you have?
Let's see, about 75, give or take. That's in total, including our professional flight engineers.
And most people, when they come here, this is where they're going to stay.
Yeah, we have turnover. Extremely low turnover.
Right.
I haven't seen anybody leave here for another job. Well, we did have one captain who wanted to do some work in Africa.
Okay.
And she did, and is doing quite well over at SAF Air, as a matter of fact.
Oh, excellent.
But other than that, we have no turnover. They either retire, we've had a death, and we have had a couple that we've had to let go.
Right.
But nobody has come up and said, I'm going to another company.
Right, which that's what I've seen as well. It also seems like you get hired here, persistence seems that I know someone who tried for years and finally, and he actually, I think he asked Red Dog, he said, what do I need to do? And Red Dog said, well, we want you to do this, this, and this. He went and did this, this, and this, and he's here now.
Well, that's fantastic to hear that somebody wants to work here bad enough that they keep after it.
I'll tell you who later on.
and a lot of it, of course, Aiden, is just timing. I happen to
need someone and
fall in when they were expanding quickly and they needed pilots and they wanted guys that had Alaska, this place originally was only going to be an all-Alaska airline.
But if someone's interested in working here, you would say probably don't give up.
Absolutely. I have guys that still call me.
Not every day, but
once a month or every couple of months just to see if there's anything going. And, that's the case. Keep after it. Of course, there's never any guarantees. But
don't get discouraged if you say, we don't have anything.
If you happen to get me on a bad day, don't get discouraged. Because tomorrow will be a good day.
That's right, yep. Cool. And some of your guys, like I know with you left Alaska and went back to Tennessee.
And that's what I was going to get to. We have what's called gateway basing. I described you the schedule up here, and I would say still the bulk of our guys do live in Alaska, but we have quite a few now that are living in the lower 48, and one in London. And we have the gateway basing program, which if you can justify, it's not hard and fast, and it's always pending the needs of the company, but for instance, me, when my wife decided that it was time for us to go live down the lower 48 for a while, be with her family, I was able to show the management here at the time that me moving to Knoxville, Tennessee was cost effective for them based on the schedule or the bid line that I could hold, which was basically McGuire or over in Europe. Alaska tends to go real senior.
Right, yep.
So, I wasn't senior enough to hold Alaska.
They were also interested enough in you being happy with what you're doing.
Yeah.
To figure out a way for you to go live
somewhere. So, and that still holds true today. If a guy comes to me and says, look, I want to, and I've had that, Randy Sanderson, you might remember
him. Yeah, I didn't even know.
Yeah, he's down, he's gateway based in North Carolina.
Wow, that knew him at UDARE. Yeah, tell him hi. That would be weird.
I know. I talk to him all the time.
Excellent.
He's now gateway based, and I'd have to look where it is, somewhere in North Carolina. But basically, we'll gateway base you to the the closest international airport, because we do have to send you internationally. If you live in Toad Suck, Arkansas, we're not going to pay for you to get from Toad Suck over to Little Rock.
Right.
You're on your own for that, but you get to Little Rock, or, you know, it might even be as far as Dallas, depending.
Right. Then we
get their tickets out of DFW and send them wherever they need to go.
And you pretty much set up in McGuire. I mean, you bought a car.
I did. Only because, you know, we did have company and still do have company vehicles, but there's, of course, a crew of three plus...
Loadmaster?
And on our military contracts, we generally don't run loadmasters with them because they're all palletized. We have the roller system.
Okay.
It's easy on, easy off. It's not a big deal. All our ad hoc operations and our Alaska operations have loadmasters on them.
Yeah, the ad hoc always sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a line you want every month. But
some guys love it.
I stay at Robert at Mike's house, so I talk to Robert.
Yep.
It can be a pain in the rear.
It can be.
But you don't, it's interesting.
You never know where you're going to be, and that's probably the hardest part
of
the ad hoc line.
You're a single guy.
If you're a single guy or even a married guy, you know, because it is finite. It's 2 weeks.
Yep.
Occasionally, we ask you to stay beyond, or we have ways to keep you on.
But you have an interesting, I mean, if you go beyond your 2 weeks, there's a bonus or...
Day off pay.
There's a day off pay.
That's correct.
So that's nice.
Yeah, and it pretty much, it's a good day off pay policy.
Right.
We tried to avoid it from my standpoint as much as possible. However, rather than lose a large trip because we have to change a crew out, I'd much rather pay the day off pay than lose the trip, so...
So how is this whole lifestyle, not just Lyndon? Lyndon's probably a little bit better, but Lyndon, you're gone a lot, too. What's it, I mean, on family life? Pilots are notoriously hard.
You know, you get 2 weeks off a month, and I did it for 9 years.
Right. You're married, two kids.
I'm married, two children, and much as any other aviation professional, I did miss my fair share of birthdays and holidays and what have you, but you do, for at least at this company, we don't monkey with your days off.
You're going to be home when you're supposed to be home.
You can plan, by and large, on being home on your days off, and then that's a spread of days off in a row. It's a two on, two off. Or in Papua New Guinea, three on, three off program.
Did that influence your decision to get into management here at Lyndon, you know, back into management, or
no?
A lot of factors.
The person that was here, I really liked the way this place was set up.
Right.
You know, like any airline, you always get a gripe or two about something. But by and large, my tenure as a line pilot here was fantastic, and person that held my chair before I did was getting ready to retire, and that man had really set this place up nicely. He asked me several times because I was quite content living in Knoxville, Tennessee, doing my two and two.
It's easy.
No stress. There's very little stress in being a line pilot, especially at a company like Lyndon Air Cargo, because they do take care of their people. And I was asked a couple of times to consider getting back into management. It's been 10 years since I'd left Hagland.
Right.
And it did take quite a bit of considering for me to get back in it, but the thing I think that made me decide to go ahead and do it was that I liked the way this place was operated. I liked the former management. I liked the policies and procedures, and my biggest fear was that they were going to get somebody from outside the company to come in, and that's just turmoil most of the time.
Yeah.
And I know you've been through that a couple of times at some of the places you've worked at. I liked the way it was. I had no illusions of making any huge changes. You know, we've slowly, as our business model has changed, we've had to do a few things different. You know, we don't carry near the amount of DOD contracts that we had before.
Right.
So in this new ad hoc, it's not new, but more emphasis on ad hoc that we have now, we've had to change a few things and streamline a few things. And we grow.
Yeah.
Like anybody else.
It seems like even with those contracts that ended, your ad hoc plane seemed pretty busy.
What I notice is on a revenue per hour basis, we do as well, even better. But it is cyclical, very cyclical. We can go for months where it's very, very slow.
Plane just sits in.
Just sits in Singapore, or it sits in Malaysia, or it sits wherever it happens to be, and we'll get the occasional ad hoc trip, but and then something will bust loose, we'll sign
Haiti
a contract, or yeah, that's a prime example, Haiti,
yep.
Or the recent spill in the Gulf of Mexico,
right,
and our support work there, there's, and then it's, you're very, very, very busy for a 3 or 4, 5 month period.
Right.
And then you're back. So it's a lot more cyclical, and that can be, from my standpoint, managerial standpoint, that's tough to watch.
But now you're in management too. You get approached by a lot of. Well, this changed. Let me go back as a DO. It's just your job to run the airline.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just running it, you know, safely and legally, and just kind of keeping everything running smoothly. Now, as the vice president of airline operations, love that title, by the way, you've got more business interests, and you're getting contacted by people. Hey, can you do this? And it's up to you to decide, can we do that?
Yeah, we our model is you know we have a pretty strong sales team.
Okay.
They field the bulk of those type of calls. When I start getting contacted by them, it's usually for technical type questions or answers. I don't have a whole lot to do with the sales portion of it.
Right.
Matter of fact, the way we're structured is I have 6 airplanes. I lease them to our sales department.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
And they have to
figure
pay my rates. So it's, and I've never, you know, this is my first upper management job at an airline. I'm not sure how other airlines structured. I think that works real well for us.
Right.
You know, we're very fortunate that our sales staff has been here as long or longer than I have, and in the case of our vice president of sales, has been involved with Herc's since the AIA days on the North Slope.
So you're getting
the pipeline.
You're getting a lot of help, kind of from the folks either up with you or
that's
sort of from underneath you, kind of saying, "Hey,
that's
right,
correct.
You need to do this."
That's correct.
And your chief pilot's still Red Dog.
He is.
He's been here for a million
He's
years.
He's been here since the start. He was with Mark Air before that, Great Northern Airlines before that, and then a whole host of smaller operators all over Alaska and part of the lower 48 at one time.
So I think he's a good person to lean on as well.
I lean on. He fulfills his job, which is keeping me supplied with
pilots.
Appropriately checked and qualified pilots, and he does it quite well.
Excellent. Well, it's probably getting close to time to wrap this up. So two last questions here. One is, what advice would you give to someone who's just getting into aviation, and they want to, who's maybe not heading towards the airlines, but looking for a slightly different career path?
First of all, make sure that, and usually if you've made that decision, you are committed to it. can be a frustrating business to get into. Use any contact that you have, and I mean any contact. If you have a great uncle whose second wife was a flight attendant at Eastern Airlines and knows somebody somewhere,
right,
use it, because that's a lot of what it takes to get on these days. Be prepared for ups and downs that are exaggerated over what you might normally expect in the economy as a whole.
Right.
Because, you know, if the times are great in the economy, generally it's very, very busy and a good time to be involved with aviation, and you might be at a point where you go, oh my God, it's so busy, I'm never going to have a personal life. Conversely, if the economy is bad, you're going to see it exaggerated in this business. At least that's the way it's been throughout my career. I've been real lucky. I've always been employed.
Right.
It's not always been where I wanted to be employed or doing what I wanted to do, but I've always had a job in aviation. So be prepared for that. Do your homework for anybody that you're going to apply to, and I don't care if it's Joe's 135 outfit in Greenville, South Carolina.
Learn something about it before you apply or before
exactly.
you get an interview.
Exactly. Don't come in not knowing who it is, what they do, and what they're looking for. And with the internet and everything today, it's fairly easy to get that accomplished. Ask
right.
questions of people who have worked there. You know, look them up.
All right. Final question. What would you do different, if anything, if you were going to start back in Texas and you knew what you knew now, what you know?
That's a good question. I haven't really considered that.
Pretty happy where you're at?
I wouldn't have changed a whole lot. I might have changed an occasion or two or a decision or two that I made during my career, but it would be just at that moment.
Right.
But the overall plan, of course, is different than what I had come up here like everybody else. I was going to fly for 3 or 4 years, get my time, get some twin turbine time, some twin turbine PIC, and go back and fly for Southwest.
Right.
I never quite made it back there. But I don't know that I would change anything that I've done that kept me away from going back there. I've thoroughly enjoyed it up here. I've thoroughly enjoyed the path that my career has taken me. Like I said, you know, there's always the decision or two along the way that you wish you could take back.
The overall general trend was...
But the overall general trend has been perfect.
Cool.
For me, anyway.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
You got it.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.